Well, today we have got one of the grand masters of the Crop Circle community, if not the grand master of Crop Circles, with us, Colin Andrews, who has a new book out, Crop Circle Signs of Contact, and it is fabulous. I have read the entire book. I have looked at the marvelous illustrations, and it is just about the most interesting and entertaining book about crop circles I've ever read. Colin, I'm so happy to have you on the program, and what I'd like to do is to start out where nobody seems to start out here anymore. Everybody knows exactly who you are and so forth, but do we really? Could you tell us a little bit about how you came to the crop circle world?
Well, thank you for having me on, Whitley.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Well, how I came to the crop circle world was that I was driving a regular day, a summer day in July 1983, between offices of, I was a senior officer in the British regional government, and I was on my way to a meeting, and I was driving on high ground. I just looked out to my left, a casual glance on a very pleasant day, and everything suddenly changed right there when I caught sight of five perfect circles forming a cross, a Celtic cross, a large circle of maybe 70 feet in diameter, with four satellites, 12 or 13 feet, I suppose, across, equally spaced north, south, east, west, pretty well, around that central circle. And that really was where it began. I stopped my vehicle. I looked more carefully at it. I could see no tracks in or out of the field. I was on high ground, so I was in a good position to look at that. And I was late for my meeting because I actually walked down this steep embankment into the field and made my way best I could to the spot and walked into the first of those five circles, and there was absolutely not a mark in that field. I was, as an engineer myself, very impressed by what I was looking at. You know, the plants swirled, and as we've now come to see them regularly on television programs and the newspapers, swirled around in the conventional way, very precise cutoff points, and as I say, looking at the centers of each of those circles, no compression, no damage whatsoever, and the only tracks in were my own. So it was a very impressive start, and I was hooked right there with me on the spot.
I can imagine where you would be, Colin. It must have been a really extraordinary experience, and the reason I wanted to start there is I'm very impressed with the book. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you.
And, you know, Ann and I read, between the two of us, about four books a week, and I'd say 80% of them we don't finish.
Right.
But when Ann handed me this, she said, "This is wonderful."
Oh,
and
it
is, and it's a very complex book, folks, in a certain way. It's easy to read. In other words, it's not a scientific book at all, but it contains a lot of science, a lot of wisdom, and it is the work of a man who has evolved a very complicated and in some ways misunderstood relationship with these crop circles. And we're going to try to get kind of past the usual today, because these are listeners who they know this phenomenon backwards and forwards, let's put it that way, and
yeah.
And they're ready to get into the deeper levels of this experience of crop circles. And you're certainly the man to take us there, because goodness knows you have been through the crop circle fire. And
that's for sure.
Now, let me ask you this. I'll start out this way. Do you think that if you had not brought this to the attention of the world, that the crop circles would have evolved the way they did? And I'm not trying to put this on you as a sort of a crop circle guru at all. What I mean is, if we hadn't looked at them, would they have evolved?
That's a great question. I've often wondered myself, I have to say. I have two takes on it, and I'll give you my bottom line feeling. One is that they've impressed me as being in need of attention, and having received that attention initially by just the three of us, that small team initially back there in 1983, not letting go, keeping the focus there, I think ultimately is what was required. But it's become an interactive phenomena, which I'm sure we'll get to during the program.
Oh, very definitely.
And therefore, I have asked myself the same question, would it have remained waving its hand, waving the white flag, as it were, in the field, waiting for somebody or a number of somebodies to apply themselves and to think about them, or would they simply have arrived as a unique opportunity for perhaps mankind himself and simply have disappeared if they hadn't been seen and paid attention to? So I really, of course, I don't know the answer to that, but the fact that we were in awe of what we were looking at, you could say, I mean, I don't want to overplay my hand here, but it really did feel almost like a religious experience. There was a physical, it was like a switch being thrown in my stomach, and each of us said the same thing. It was almost like that day was always going to happen to us, and that we were in some way perhaps intended to. I don't know that either. But we did pay attention, and we did focus, and we didn't let go. And, you know, the first book came out, it's Circular Evidence in 89, and the television and all the rest of it that followed. And suddenly, those impressive little single circles became national and then international news. So it is a great question. It's one we'll never know the answer to. But my gut feeling is that it happened to be three individuals, all from the sciences initially,
yes.
Two engineers and a physicist, you know, Pat Delgado, my first co-author, having just retired from the Mariner project with NASA, and Dr. Terence Meaden, a meteorologist and a physicist. That in itself is pretty bizarre, but here are three of us in our own regions, southern England near Stonehenge, coming across those simple circles and suddenly having switches thrown inside of us. Those were ours, that's how it felt. And whether we were doing a favor to the phenomenon, or to humanity, ultimately, I guess, we will see down the road, but we are now, or I'm the only one left of those, that initial three, still looking at it. But now, of course, we have many others coming from all diverse fields and areas of expertise. And for sure, whether the phenomenon now would like us to leave or not, it isn't going to happen.
No.
They're here until we, I guess, understand more about them.
Well, we are here, and they're here. And it almost seems as if perhaps there's been something here in the larger sense, maybe for a very long time, that has been kind of continuously putting out these feelers, if it were, as crop circles or various different types of phenomena and apparitions, and waiting for a response from us. And
yeah.
one of the things about that annoys me a little bit about a lot of crop circle books is that they don't do the kind of deep research that's necessary to actually find out what went on in the past, in the distant past. And you just sum it up so nicely. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this phenomenon's long and rather mysterious history?
Yeah, well, there's a lot, of course, that we're not too sure about as far as the deep distant past is concerned.
Right.
That, you know, we know that there are references to what appear to be crop circles right back in the 1600s. But there is no question that since 1975, they showed up in central southern England. There was a glut of activity which perhaps and probably was the same phenomenon in 1966, related to certainly UFO activity, as you know, down in Queensland, Australia.
Well, tell us a little bit about that.
Right, well, this was a farmer who was on his tractor driving past a lagoon at Tully, Queensland, and saw a disc-shaped object rise up from the lagoon. His tractor malfunctioned immediately, its engine ceased to operate. As his engine died, he could hear the hissing sound of this object. As it lifted over his head, it wavered a little, a few feet above him, and disappeared into the distance. He rather gingerly got off of his tractor and looked through the low hedgerow there into the lagoon, and could see that the plants that had been in sort of a marshland-type situation had been pulled away from their roots and were now floating and still rotating in a circular motion, in a circular geometry, on the top of the water. So that was the beginning of a whole series of simple geometry circles at Tully, frequently associated with orbs or certainly airborne objects, which we'll obviously call UFOs at the, for want of another term. And they also were to appear regularly and still do in central southern England, but certainly smaller as far as the size of the report that came out of Tully back in 66. I've certainly seen them myself several times in that Stonehenge area around Alston Barnes, about 18 inches in diameter. And I think it really was from the orbs that we got the, I certainly got the first sense that here were objects that, as of themselves, we couldn't account for, we couldn't explain away, but they were showing an awareness. They certainly were aware of the topography because they maneuvered and manipulated them, their positioning around the contours of the ground and around and over trees, over tractor drivers, and have been filmed now many times. So these objects were not moving randomly. They were, it looked as if they were observing the crop markings, which were always nearby. Indeed, on many occasions, actually moving, floating just above ground level, actually through the crop markings, sometimes with people actually in the circles at the same time. So here we have orbs that appear to have, to be playing some part, perhaps, of the overall manifestations of the crop markings. It is certainly aware, anyway, of being present in the locality. So, you know, that really is a sort of a brief background to how they showed up and how they tended to indicate to us that there was consciousness or awareness was involved with them, if not with the markings themselves. And it was later that, when in my case, 1987, when, I mean, purely a coincidental set of circumstances led me to strongly believe that something was reading our minds in the crop markings themselves. You know, I had been with a group of researchers, Terence Mead and Pat Dalgan, over two of them, and right. others, at a place called Kempton, near Andover, where I lived. This was about, I suppose, 20 miles from Stonehenge. And I went back there in the evening, having been there during the afternoon with them. I went back just to take a single measurement that I had overlooked. You know, I put my paperwork and it was gone. And I stood in the standing crop close to this ring, which a pilot had discovered. And I said in my mind, not being an overly religious person, I was praying to God, and I don't know who God is either, but I said in my mind, you know, please God, give me a clue as to what this is all about. You know, we had been looking at them then for several years already, and absolutely immediately, as if in response to that sincere request on my part, began this very strange electrostatic crackling sound. It was high energy, you know, coming from my engineering background in electrical engineering, I was familiar with a similar sound when you were increasing voltages between anode and cathode to, you know, many millions of volts, and just before you get the discharge, you get this ionizing crackling sound, and the ionization of the air and the breakdown of the insulation of the air, and you get this crackling and then the bang on the discharge. And I had been stood there quietly in total serenity in a peaceful place one moment and was frightened out of my life the next, because the sound just increased in intensity until I could feel the air moving on my cheeks of my face. And I started to look to run out of the field to get away from it, and it seemed to read that emotion too, because as soon as I reached that, as I'm speaking to you, the hairs are rising on my arms, I guess I'm reliving it, and it ceased. It seemed absolutely as if my request to that higher place, I'll call it God, in some way was interacting with me, and that I do believe to this day that I was about to see something manifest, but that I wasn't able to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And I really did turn off the experience.
A very familiar problem,
yeah.
Colin. I have been in, not with crop circles, but in a similar situation myself, and I always thought to myself afterwards, why did I turn away?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a little break now. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back.
You've heard this extraordinary music as intro and outro on many of my Dreamland shows. It's called Deja Blues by Stephen Halpern. The music taps into ancient healing codes and sound and can help you time travel to mystic times and spaces, or can activate past life memories, deepen your meditations, and evoke pure listening pleasure. Treat yourself and explore the subtle dimensions of sound, and take advantage of our free bonus offer. Order Deja Blues and Inner Peace and receive a third CD, Higher Ground, for free. You'll receive all three CDs for the price of just two for $29.98. That's a savings of over $17. Just ask for Halpern's Dreamland Special number 3. Call 1-800-909-0707 or order online at www.stephenhalpern.com. That's 1-800-909-0707 or www.stephenhalpern.com. Please ask for Halpern's Dreamland Special number 3.
Colin Andrews stunned the world by saying 80% of crop circles were man-made, but what nobody heard was the other side of that statement. 20% of them were truly anomalous, and that's why he calls his new book, Crop Circles, Signs of Contact. That's right, Signs of Contact. Is there an esoteric code hidden in their patterns? Are they manifestations of human consciousness? Could they be screams from a dying planet? Are they some kind of warning signal or danger? Are they made by aliens? What a book, Crop Circles, Signs of Contact. Colin has said 80% of them are man-made, but even that is very, very strange. And that other 20%, we're looking straight into the eyes of another world. Get Crop Circles, Signs of Contact from the unknowncountry.com store. Just click on store. We'll take it from there. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're talking with one of the great grandmasters of the crop circle, of crop circle research, Colin Andrews. His new book, Crop Circle, Signs of Contact. Colin, I think that before we go more deeply, that it's necessary to take a little detour to chapter 17 of your book. Hate mail, threats, red-faced zealots screaming in my face, contempt, media ridicule, professional scorn, hatred, and insults. And was there anything else wrong?
Well, I guess it couldn't have been very much worse than that, could it? And it really was, Whitley. I'm pleased that you've raised it in a way, of course, because it's always good to sort of clear the air and to make my position a little clearer, hopefully.
Yeah. Tell us first, why did this happen?
Why did it happen? Yeah. Well, because I made an announcement on BBC television during the summer of 2000. I really just basically announced the results of the first 2 years of work that I have been funded by Lawrence Rockefeller to do.
Yes.
Actually a series of projects, but the one that caused the problems was looking, engaging private detectives and looking in detail at the possibilities of people making crop circles. And the short version is that the results were disturbing, that 20%, which is a very large figure. I mean, I don't think that was ever really listened to, that 20% showed no signs whatsoever of a human hand in England.
Now, what was interesting was that after all of this painstaking and well-funded research, you came up with that figure, but nobody seemed to notice.
No.
I was in the middle of this, and I was fascinated because at the time I couldn't get you on Dreamland. You were too embroiled, I guess, and were unresponsive.
Right. And probably in prison, actually.
What?
Probably in prison.
In prison? Are you serious?
No, not at all. No, I mean, it was almost that bad.
But people were just spewing rage, and I kept thinking to myself, he's saying that 20% of these things are really strange, and there's a substantial amount of research that's gone into this. So tell us about the... Do you still think that figure is accurate, 80-20?
I do. It's round about that. I mean, and I rounded it up. You know, I have been criticized for where were the zeros and the points. Well, they were there, and I simply rounded it up for ease of communication. You know, I had about a 20-second slot on the first television program where that came out, and I simply said 80% were man-made, 20% were not. So the points are there, but they're really not. It doesn't matter. I mean, we were looking at those kinds of proportions, and I think that's the kind of those are the sort of figures that apply certainly to southern England, and I think that's worth saying that we have a real game going on in southern England now that didn't exist, you know, before the first book, and indeed between the first and the second book.
Mm-hmm.
The public were intrigued, fascinated. But not engaged in the sense that the fools amongst community, the society that we live in, were not out there trying to deceive us by making them, or, you know, applying their handiwork to what they call art and so on. It wasn't happening. So we were looking at a clear slate, you could say an uncontaminated scene, but the contamination soon began. And then this game developed, almost a game, where the ante, we were saying, well, you know, you cannot bend plants in this fashion. And of course, so they would try and perfect a technique where they could come somewhere near countering every move. So that's really, you know, what has been going on, but very, very disturbing. But those figures, I doubt very much that they apply on a global basis.
Now, I want to ask you a question. I've even had, there's even been some, one of the Crop Circle fellow who was arrested, what was his name?
Yes, Matthew Williams.
Matthew Williams, even at one point, actually made a circle for Dreamland for me to prove that superbly crafted circles could be made by human beings.
Right.
And it was no good.
Right.
But if 80% is a correct figure or anything even close to it, then it must be that some superbly crafted figures are being made by people.
They are.
Any of these people?
I do. Yes, I do. I say regrettably because most of them are not people you would want to employ. There's deception involved, really, and that is not a word that I enjoy working with.
When you say deception, Colin, that's a very loaded word here.
It is.
And I know you well enough to know that it has all kinds of different resonances. Why don't you get into exactly what you mean by that word?
Yeah. Well, there are those. There are different motivations for having us, the public or researchers working on, you know, one might say on behalf of the public. There are different motivations in deceiving us. One would be to pluck off or dirty, to redden the face of specific individuals, and that has been done. You know, it could be that I know quite a lot of the circumstances. I don't, at a personal level, know why Matthew Williams wanted to redden your face or Michael Glickman's or whatever. But
he didn't seem to want to redden my face. He was just trying to prove a point.
Right.
And he failed to do so. What he may or may not have done to Michael Glickman is another story.
Yeah. But there are different motivations. There are individuals that have paid farmers, and I've been right on the scene with this, where they whoever these mysterious people are. Now, I know some of these artists. There are others who I do not know. I know that they arrive in smart suits. They pay. They have paid farmers to remove the elements, the standing elements, that is the information from within certain designs, and one can only wonder whether these are people perhaps from government agencies that don't want us, any of us, to have all the information, even to research, let alone to ultimately understand. There are others that do it because they want to learn more about the human condition by entering a field which is perceived, believed, by those walking into it to be mysterious, only known by a handful of individuals to have been man-made, but they claim to be learning about the psychology, the human condition, by listening to what is said, observing what people claim in the way of healings or illnesses and all these kinds of things. But the bottom line is, and will always be, unless we apply ourselves in an open and honest fashion, there's only one other word that they're working under, the umbrella of deception. We would be years down the road in a better position of understanding what potential this has to mankind if we were working with a mankind that was united in its honesty, in its positive endeavors.
Right.
And unfortunately, it hasn't been in the past, and I doubt if it will be in the future.
And thus, there are, what you have surrounding this is the same thing that you see surrounding most unexplained and vibrant phenomena in the world today, and that is a whole lot of different human agendas, mixed agendas, and unknown agendas, all kind of swirling around together, and in this case making some rather extraordinary crop circles.
That's right.
Okay, now let's turn then, before we go on to the 20%, one of the most interesting chapters in the book I found was Cynthia's chapter, Crop Circle Empowerment. And I will tell you why. And this also relates to the crafting of some of the more remarkable circles that may have been of human creation.
Yeah.
I talked to a gentleman called J.H. Brennan. Does that ring a bell with you at all?
It rings a bell, but I can't quite...
How about Dolores Ashcroft Nowicki? No? They are two magicians who live in... Dolores is in the U.K., and Brennan is in Ireland. And I talked not to her, but to him. And... They wrote a book together called Magical Use of Thought Forms that for various reasons I thought had a great deal of real knowledge in it about the way that magic can be used to manifest in the physical world.
Right.
And at one point he subtly implied, but he was very cagey about it, that it was possible that magicians could make crop circles. Now, is there any evidence whatsoever of that? It struck me, it's one thing to create a thought form or something like that, and it may manifest physically in different ways, but it's another thing to do something that so radically changes the physical environment is like knocking over a crop in that way.
Yes. Two things I think I would say. That's again a very interesting question or point that you've made. I would say this, that certainly there is no evidence that I am aware of an individual like a magician of any kind standing in front of an untouched field and producing with his mind or by magic in some other fashion a formation in front of him. I did spend, having said that, I think we can come somewhat closer to certainly humans being involved in some fashion with the creation. I spent some while with Uri Geller back probably 15 years ago. In fact, it was all of that, because at the time the first book was just about or had just been published, and that was 1989. And whilst I was with Geller, he said, that he knew a lot about geometries and that he had been given geometries telepathically during his first UFO experience in Israel, and that he was perfectly certain that he could produce a crop circle and that we should arrange some national television to do this, a live television, and that this could be arranged with our publishers to make a lot of money for everybody, and that this is something that we should do. My point, I guess, to keep it brief, was it was unfortunately the money was the reason that it didn't happen. I don't want to go too much into that, but I don't underestimate Uri Geller's potentials and his claims at all, not at all. In fact, I'm extremely interested in his abilities, but it didn't happen. So I have no proof that it could happen in that way, but this is something that I can certainly put my name to, is that, and I'm not alone in this really at all, but I lay in bed in my first marriage, which was becoming very difficult at this particular time, and I laid in bed in Andover, in Hampshire, and again, I was coming from a very deep part of me. I can only explain it this way. I was coming from the most sincere, deepest place in my heart, in my soul, you could say, and I asked for a particular design, which was the traditional Celtic cross, five circles, four satellites like I saw in 83, but this time to have those four satellites connected by a ring. And this particular design has never appeared, had never appeared, as far as we know, anywhere on our planet ever before. That particular night, you've only got me as your witness, and this is the downside of what I'm telling you. I can only tell you that I asked for this design, and I said as close to my home as is possible, because of all the running around we were doing at the time across southern England. That very next morning, my telephone went, and Jeff Smith, who I will never forget, a farmer to the south of my town by about 5 miles, in the only cereal crops that was left unharvested at that time, although it took me 2 days to realize this, to be honest, he phoned me and he said, "We've got a pattern in this field. I think you should come and have a look at it. We're harvesting. You've only really got 2 hours because we're in the field. We've come across as we're harvesting." I telephoned Busty Taylor. We got the aircraft straight up. Within 45 minutes, we were over it. And I tell you, I had a lump come up in my throat when I looked down, and there was the Celtic cross. And it was 2 days before I realized, well, my God, that is in the field as close to my home was possible, because it was the only cereal crop left unharvested. And therefore, I guess it was a long way of me saying, it's a kind of magic, perhaps, and I was not aware of me physically putting that pattern down, but I had, from a very deep part of me, requested it. There is no doubt in my mind, really, that why the book is called Signs of Contact. We have stumbled across a phenomena which has offered a great deal, and only by engaging it at the most sincere, at the deepest level, we have got interaction. And these are signs of contact with something, and I don't know what that something is.
And it is important, I think, to not filter that unknown, in the sense of there will be those who would think, well, that must mean that aliens sitting on a spaceship up above his house heard his thoughts and then went down and did this. Or that must mean that the spirits were listening and they did this. Or it must mean that or the other thing. What it means is, it's possible in the context of this phenomenon to come face to face with a very real unknown.
I'm so pleased. You put it beautifully. And I quite agree with that. An agent that I had a while back, who was interested in getting this word out, you know, as many are, had said to me, "What you are saying, you have to be saying these are extraterrestrials. It's the only possibility." And I said, "No, absolutely not. Just as you've said, until we know for certain, we must leave it unfiltered." I think you're absolutely right.
And Oh, we got to take a little break here. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. Strieber, it's Dreamland. We're talking to Colin Andrews. We're trying to get a little bit deeper into the crop circle phenomenon than usual, and we have taken flight in the sense of going beyond the usual assumptions about what may be causing this. And I would like to now go sweeping back into the past, Colin, because the material that you have about the relationship between the circles and Stonehenge is absolutely fascinating and may be very, very relevant to this discussion. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you discovered?
Well, Busty Taylor, I would give the credit for first saying to me during the winter of 12 or more years ago now, that when he was flying over from the base that he used to take off from, or still does take off from, that he noticed that there were striking similarities, as he could see, in flying over Stonehenge to not only the design, but to the approximate sizing, the proportions, to the circles that he had been looking at himself since 1985. And so I spent the whole of that winter pulling back out of our database all of the measurements, which were precise. You know, we would break a circle up into eight arcs, radii, for measuring, so they were very precise. And I obtained from English Heritage the ground plan for Stonehenge, and staggering accuracy within just centimeters of the actual floor design of Stonehenge were all of the simple early crop circle designs, whether these were simple circles or whether they had the single rings around them or the double rings, they fitted into the proforma layout of Stonehenge itself, and to extremely similar proportions, I'd say within centimeters. And it was really on the back of that discovery that Michael Grace from Ghost 2, I believe, the director of Ghost 2 movie, came over with a film crew and was putting together a short movie for American television. And this is something I don't often discuss these days. I guess it sort of moved into some other clouded areas here and there, but I think it is relevant. I was on camera discussing this very thing that we're now talking to, you and I, and during the filming, a psychic, Sharon, I've forgotten her last name, from the States, was with him as a friend, and of course he was stood behind the camera, and she suddenly shouted out, breaking right into the filming, which Michael of course stopped, "Colin, they are telling me to tell you to pick up your stone." It was like total silence. Michael was furious. it was totally bizarre. And I looked down to my feet, and there are many flint, this is a particular type of stone in central southern England, which is fairly unusual. And I looked down, and I saw one that was by next to my right foot that was rounded. There was a rounded end on it, which was very unusual. I levered it out of the ground. It was hardened and secure where presumably it had been when they cultivated the field the year before, and it sort of embedded itself. I pulled it out. I wiped it off. It had a flat surface underneath. I just wiped it on, you know, on my trouser leg, and there was no, it's in the book, as I think you'll have seen, Whitley, and just about a photo mirror image of Stonehenge itself. It had the standing stones, it had the heel stone, not just on the stone, the flint stone, which is at least 60 million years old, but precisely placed where the heel stone at Stonehenge is. And then there was another sphere to the left at, I think, something like about 180 degrees, something like that, off the top of my head I'm saying this, where I didn't know at that time, but that 6 years later, I would discover a design, a crop design, which is one in the catalog of designs that appears all around the world for the first time on a stone at Stonehenge. And that new design was on a stone precisely where this 60 million year old flint told me it would be. I mean, it is just totally extraordinary in every respect. So, I mean, how does one explain that away? I just don't know. I just simply do not know. But the psychic picks something up in the middle of the interview, and that is on camera.
That is simply amazing, and it's so... It almost suggests a kind of, as if the Earth had a voice itself, and that it was speaking to us, you know, rather than aliens. That it's some kind of ancient presence that is conscious, very much so, but not in the same way that we are.
Right, absolutely. And you see, those you make a great point, because those designs, the designs that started this whole thing off in the fields, are absolutely identical to those that have been recorded in the artwork of the native peoples, the Aborigines, you know, the Dogon, the Dogons, the Native Americans, the Hopi, the Celts.
Yeah.
These are all the same design. They all started in the same place, and they indeed are the phosphenes of the human mind. So there is a very basic building block here that we've got to understand, I think, before we can move too many leaps and bounds down the road towards, ultimately, who is it that we're interacting with. There is interaction, that I am certain, but the who, I'm just not there.
Well, you know, there's a many levels of who, and I'll give you an example of what I mean. Back some years ago, I was riding in the subway in New York, and I had just had the communion experience, this close encounter, and I was still very much up in the air as to what in the world it might have been, as I, to a great extent, still am. But in any case, I noticed someone had just painted something, a graffito on the subway, wall of the subway, and it was truly remarkable. What it was a negative. They had painted a negative of a face. In other words, it was like looked like the Shroud of Turin would look.
Right.
And done it very, very exquisitely. And the paint, what was so strange was, the paint was still wet. It was obvious, it had just been done while I was sitting right there. I hadn't seen it done.
Right.
But then I noticed that there were two young women standing at the door. This was right beside the doors.
Yeah.
And they were speaking. They looked very normal, very nice-looking young women, and they were talking together and looking at me as if they were talking together about me. And when I began to look at this thing at more and more in puzzlement, they began to laugh.
Bizarre.
And I said, "Excuse me, did you just do that?" And the doors opened, and they went out into the crowd at the 42nd Street station. I got up to follow them, jumped out of the car, not at my own stop, never saw them again. And what I'm saying is this. There are people around with really weird abilities.
Yeah.
And they might not be entirely people in the way you and I are.
I'm with you.
And maybe they're out there in the fields.
I'm with you. You know, Whitley, this is perhaps a little off of the subject, perhaps it isn't, but it's very much in keeping with what you have just described. If I may, I'd like to share it with you, particularly yourself, because I know the experiences you've had. My witness to what I'm about to say is my wife, Cynthia, who wrote the chapter that you've been referring to.
Yes.
Well, Cynthia and I were having a weekend away up in Massachusetts, the adjacent state here, and got up in the morning, we went to this little, rickety little cafe, no more than seven or eight tables in it, in this little out-of-the-way place, and it was just a normal day. We went in there, and they were waiting to be served, and into my mind, I can only say, put it this way, I knew it wasn't my thought process, because it just was suddenly in my mind, placed in my mind, and what it said, I know we're talking to a lot of people here, and I know it can sound foolish, but I'm just going to give it to you as it was, because I've never understood how this worked. it said to me, there was a single sentence that said, you are about to see an extraterrestrial. And that came out of nowhere. It took me seconds to wonder why and how that thought had come into my mind. And I related to my wife. Moments later, I said, I just had the strangest thought. It just came straight into me. And I related it. And I tell you that less than five minutes, there were two individuals came up on a tricycle with a bicycle with two seats on it.
Tandem bike.
Right. Came up outside, they leaned the bicycle against the building, came in, and you've just reminded me of this, is that the two of them came through the door. The guide came through the door first, was perfectly ordinary looking person. The woman with him was short, with a large head and a high forehead, and she made immediate eye contact with me, and I was reading her as saying, you knew I was coming. And I tell you, as much as I could do, Whitley, she came in, they came in, but she was absolutely burning my head, burning my mind. She was going right through my eyes, and they sat down, and I should have done what you did and spoke up. I've, to this day, regretted not saying, I know who you are to her. Because I know to this day she knew. And I've never understood why it happened. But like you said, I mean, these are people that look fairly normal, and yet that was an experience which was out of the ordinary, and
yes,
it demonstrated something to me.
Well,
so I don't know where it all takes us, but it's not all that straightforward.
Well, yeah, and that's where it does take us, because this is I see the crop circle phenomenon as a confluence of a lot of different elements. I think that there are many different levels on which crop circles are made, and some of them are human levels that the great majority of us know nothing about. Undoubtedly. And I think that might account for the craftsmanship of some of the most extraordinary ones. And we're going to take a little break, and then afterwards I'd like to talk about some of the most finely crafted ones that you feel sure are man-made.
Okay.
This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. Colin Andrews stunned the world by saying 80% of crop circles were man-made, but what nobody heard was the other side of that statement. 20% of them were truly anomalous, and that's why he calls his new book, Crop Circles, Signs of Contact. That's right, Signs of Contact. Is there an esoteric code hidden in their patterns? Are they manifestations of human consciousness? Could they be screams from a dying planet? Are they some kind of warning signal or danger? Are they made by aliens? What a book, Crop Circles, Signs of Contact. Colin has said 80% of them are man-made, but even that is very, very strange. And that other 20%, we're looking straight into the eyes of another world. Get Crop Circles, Signs of Contact from the unknowncountry.com store. Just click on store. We'll take it from there. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're talking to Colin Andrews, and among his more controversial statements in recent years, if I don't think you've ever made too many statements publicly that weren't controversial, Colin, one way or another, is that 80% of crop circles are man-made. I remember when you said that, steam came out of my ears, too. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, you know, just listen. It's not my job to judge, but to listen. And it's what I do on the radio. And
yeah. So
I just sort of watched and waited and to see what would happen. And now we've kind of gotten to the dust has cleared. And
yeah.
So tell us now, give us an example of a crop circle that was fashioned to a level that would convince any researcher that it was genuinely anomalous, that you feel strongly or even can prove was man-made.
Well, most of, and it sounds to be a very outlandish thing to say, but most of the 80% in that two-year period, I can prove, were man-made.
By and what means can you prove this?
I can prove it. I'll run through some of this with you. First of all, the aerial photographs were taken of just about everything that occurred in England during that two-year period. I personally inspected most of, not every single one, of them, and we were looking for specific information. That information was, put simply, that if a geometry is a perfect circle, then something or somebody needs to stand in the center to make it, apart from, of course, drop down from a helicopter. And so therefore we were looking for compression, access to the construction points, in this case access to the center of the circle, and you cannot get to the center in standing crop without leaving evidence of some kind when they're made by people. And so we were looking for the 2, 3, or 4 inch wide pathways from access points to these construction points, and we found them. When a plant is flattened and remains flat to the ground, it is therefore not stood up vertically to be used in the flattening process of the overall geometry. So the initial stage of the construction is concealed underneath the completed geometry, and so therefore that gives us second pieces of information to be looking for, and that is what we also found. In complex geometries, there has to be a layout design and method, and again we were looking for that would fit the human construction method, and would find, and again photographic evidence is here on the assessment CD, which is available to the public to look at, pin marks where the people like Matthew Williams and others up in London, the so-called Team Satan and Circle Makers, of which there are now quite a few of them, were placing pins at these specific places where they needed to mark other arcs and contours and chords and all sorts. So we were looking at that. So what I'm saying is you're piecing this together. So therefore the next step was to infiltrate some of the groups involved to convince them that these people working with them were either media or other interest researchers, which was also done. And I, at this point, would not wish to name the individuals that were used for this purpose. But we do have the footage, low-light and image-intensifying film, used in the construction of some of those complex geometries during their construction. So as you piece this together, layer upon layer upon layer, all obviously funded, so we could do a lot more with that money than I have been able to do with my own over many years. You know, we were left with very convincing evidence. You know, one cannot get much more than those pieces of information that I've given you and the film of it being made as well. So that was really what, you know, that pulled the 80% figure together. And none of the evidence that I've been pointing out to you that we were looking for and discovering was evident in the other designs, the 20%, which tended to be less complex, much more in keeping with the designs which, funnily enough, and now perhaps logically, appear worldwide. Mm-hmm. You know, the designs, a type 1 pattern is a single circle, a type 2 is 2, type 3 is 3 in a straight line, type 5 is 5 forming a cross, and so on, running right through the whole range that we've seen and now catalogued, which are also in the book there. Only the more, that's not quite true, I was about to say only the most simple, but most of the simple designs appear worldwide and were very much part of that 20%. It was also, strangely enough, and logically perhaps, the same simple designs that people have seen as eyewitnesses, seen forming in bizarre circumstances in many parts of the world. These were not designs like Solar System 2, which is the one that Williams had a hand in for the British movie A Place to Stay. That was a complex design executed and filmed, being made by people like the spider web of, what was that, 96 or 97, complex design, very impressive. But it still does leave, and I would want to get this in before the phone starts ringing on us again, is that there are other complex geometries which have no signs whatsoever of a human hand, and that's where I have to be careful, perhaps of not being careful enough in making my case here, that whilst I'm saying most of the simple designs are the 20%, in that 20%, and are not made by people, it is true that the galaxy design, for example, of 2 years ago, that extraordinary pattern, you know, was 650,000 square feet, and the Julia set of 1996 opposite Stonehenge, as sure as we can be, after 20 years of looking at this, were not made by people.
Which is extraordinary when you think about it, especially because of the, you know, Terence Meaden, of course, had a theory for a long time, and we'll get into that in a minute,
yeah.
that this was essentially a kind of a natural phenomenon, but present scientific theory, does not account for or include the concept that nature itself may have a consciousness or a level of mind at all. And so he was kind of left behind by that particular formation, as I recall.
You're absolutely right. That was exactly where, I mean, he got the last part of the name right, I think, by saying, well, it could be natural. If he had put it could be supernatural or natural, I think he would still be in the mix. He left the scene because what we were beginning to see, there was that phase of this evolving phenomena that suddenly one could not begin to explain this away as a natural meteorological occurrence.
Yes.
In the terms that, you know, we were looking at straight lines and arcs of the most complex kind.
Well, it either was acting according to a rigorous intelligence or a set of natural rules that seemed indistinguishable from the acts of an intelligence. And I refer back now to the relationship between the circles and the measurements of Stonehenge that you referred to earlier. Perhaps that isn't a conscious reference so much as it is the appearance or the outcome of the action of natural phenomena that we don't understand.
Right.
That are inevitable in the same sense, as you point out in the book, that a chambered nautilus's measurements are inevitable and would seem the outcome of design, but are actually natural engineering because it simply isn't going to work any other way.
Right, right. As chaos itself is now, as we now know, at least a some stage of order, and that whilst it appears to be chaotic, random, and scattered, applying the mathematics that apply to that boundary between order and chaos, one gets a geometry which we can talk about. And that geometry and those proportions are natural in the sense that they have to be where they are. It is simply where they have to be because it's the boundary between those physical laws. So, you know, the Mandelbrot set, really, I think, was in itself really quite important when that first showed up.
Yes.
You know, I believe 1990 now, 89-90, it was showing us for the first time that if that pattern was real and that it truly was communicating information to us, this was a predictive stage which, through the eyes of some, and I happen to be one of them, believe that if this was communicating something to us, it was showing us that we were moving towards a state of chaos, and that was a possibility. You know, we had many other designs from fractal mathematics, the Julia set being one of them, that followed and reinforced that if these were all real, and I believe them to be, that this was something we could work with. I mean, after all, obviously looking at your website and others that are commenting on this extraordinarily shameful world shameful world in the sense of the way that we're treating it, it exists today. This total chaos, this state of chaos, you know, with our religions collapsing, when God represents on the one hand a reason why Saddam Hussein should be fighting the evil people he's referring to, the states. We have the president this side talking to the same God. The God is behind us. We must go in and take him down. And it's this total, chaotic, shameful world that we're creating right now.
Yes.
I mean, I guess I did jump there suddenly from designs that tell us something to a state which was predicted. And this is where we are. I think with all of the anchors society has been working with suddenly pulled, I personally see that we do now have great potential because out of the chaos will come a new form of order, hopefully a better one.
Well, that's beautifully said, Colin. It really, really is, and very articulate, too. And those of you who have been sort of half listening at this point in the program, just roll back a little bit and listen again, because those are extraordinary words. Colin, how do you react to this? One of the possible motivations, not only for all of the mysterious crop circles, including the ones crafted by human beings, and I have no idea personally whether you're right or wrong about that. I don't know, but it's not my job to know. It's my job to find out what you know and what other people in the field know. But I found in my close encounter life and this close encounter experience that when one is faced with questions you cannot answer and that you cannot bear to leave unanswered, it forces you to kind of jump the wall of your assumptions into a higher level of being. And I think that's what this phenomenon is about, and I think that some of the people involved in it know that.
Yeah.
And act that way. The mysterious sort of intelligence operatives who seem to be out there kind of purposely muddying the waters and making it even harder for us to come to closure. Maybe they understand that, or maybe somebody at an even higher level, maybe even the ultimate mysterious presence that's making the circles, is directing their activities. How do you react to that?
Well, I have to say that I think you have put your finger on the very nub of what I believe this is all about. I react strongly to it because I think that the crop circles themselves have provided us a tool, an opportunity, and indeed have already proven to us, if only we were listening and interacting or attempting to go further with it, that we have a hand to play in this, and that our consciousness, the direction that the river is taking, is dictated by the collective consciousness, the mean consciousness of the people, and that the fact that we have a word in this and that we can react and interact with that higher mind, we can, far greater, I think, than most of us give credit, dictate our future. And I think that's the power of this particular mystery, that it has already proven that... I think we've covered some of this already in a way, Whitley, but what I feel to say that I've not said before, and I feel particularly to say this to you because I do know through your books of some of your experiences, the 2080, which we've covered, and perhaps we don't need to go back to in detail, but
right.
I'd like, if I may, just to tell you how it actually came about that it was announced on BBC television, because it too was bizarre, and it showed to me personally that this is a two-way experiment of which we are one part. I was back in England doing my research a year ahead of announcing the findings of the investigation into the hoaxing on the Rockefeller money, a year ahead of when we intended to announce it. Again, I had that bizarre experience where I knew it was not my thought process. I was, I'm going to say, instructed. This is a chapter in the book where I say at the end of the day, I have a feeling we're all going to realize that we were just carrying out instructions. I was Whitley. I don't know who the voice was. It was a male voice inside my head that said, you have to go with this. This 2080, that's where we were at the time. It was solid, but we wanted another year on it. There was other work to be done. You have to go on this now. And I sat up in the bed. I started making notes. The next morning, I had a phone call, and I'm prepared to give names, from BBC Television, from the newsroom in London, saying, I thought last night that it was time I gave you a call. Have you got anything new for us? And
wow.
I said, well, actually, yes, I do. It was like the person at the BBC had the prompt, I had the prompt to do it, and I later learned that people in the crop circle world that were making some of the 80% also had an extraordinary experience in London that same night to go out and make particular designs in the fields of England. Now, what I'm saying is the three elements played in to, I think, crucial timing that we put out in an honest way 2 years ago, that is man-made so that we could clear the decks and get down to this crucial time that we live in and where we need to interact with the deepest part of ourselves and to influence our future.
Yes.
By understanding who we are.
Urgent, urgent need.
Urgent, urgent.
We need to take, speaking of needs, Colin, we need to take a brief break. This is Whitley Strieber, it's Dreamland. We're back with Colin Andrews. We have been talking about his new book, Crop Circle, Signs of Contact, and it is a remarkable book. The current, most recent statement by a man on a very extraordinary journey, difficult and wondrous. No stranger to controversy is Colin and Andrews, and we were just talking about this sense of urgency, and it's almost on the back of the book. You have this question: are they screams from a dying planet? Is there anything to that?
Well, it's like so very much with this subject. It's like multifaceted. You can hone in, and we have tried to do so, and to correlate our findings with events in the world. And a very good fit, of course, was in the late 70s when we first became aware of the ozone problem that, of course, is now much worse, and a great deal more is much worse than that, too, at this time. And at that time, we became aware of the ozone problem and the escalating in the deterioration of the life support systems of what I believe to be a living planet, certainly a planet that relies upon many support systems. Correlated directly with that was the arrival of the phenomena. 75 saw the first in modern period photographic evidence with the reports. And these designs, arriving first as simple circles, began to escalate in their densities, in the report densities, in their complexity, beginning to move from A to Z more rapidly, to accelerate and to spread geographically from just two or three hot spots to a global phenomena. That all tied in, certainly in the same period. That's all that I think one could say and prove with the environment and the environmental situation. We have, because we accept that as fact, we have looked at the 10,000 or so designs, many more than most of the public or the media in general are aware, that there are many, many more reports than most people are aware of. The book shows, at the back of the book is the catalogue of patterns, every pattern that has appeared anywhere for the first time in one place. But what is not in that book are those that are still to this day not entered into the system, which we believe to be about 10,500 designs. Well, when you look at those designs, one, just looking at it in a grounded, rational way, we look at those designs and break them up into families. By families, I mean that some of these designs clearly give us information we do understand, like the solar system of 1989, I think it was 88, 89.
Yes.
Well, that first solar system that we call it number one because it was, there were attempts to replicate it by Matthew Williams and others for the British movie, came somewhere near it, but of course caused damage and all the things that we've talked about in that 2080 discussion we had. Where here we have the first solar system without any damage, with tremendous complexity, with tremendous accuracy, and having worked for 6 months with the head of astronomy at Boston, Gerald Hawkins at the time, and astrophysicist,
right.
Dr. Hadley here at Yale University, looking at what that pattern might be. Well, there, it clearly is the solar system, and to tremendous accuracy. So here we have a whole range of patterns which tell us these are astronomical units, astronomical bodies. There are others that are spiritual, that man has recognized or certainly have recorded, that has an emotional impact with him. So this has emotional content, and that's another range, another family of designs, which are spiritual. These are spiritual symbols. There are others that are pure mathematics that have only been understood in recent times, like the fractal geometry, the chaos theory, and so on. So one builds up that we are looking at multifaceted information of one kind or another. But I think, personally, this is just a pure personal take on it, Whitley. I think that in a way, I don't wish to sound arrogant, and it can sound to be that, but I don't think, as important as it might be, the content of each individual design, I think the fact that we can interact with the manifestation of it, as well as the content of it, and the understanding of it, in emotional terms, is really what it's about. We are now living in a time, if we do not grab those reins back and take control over the people that are leading us to the precipice, we will lose it for all and forever. And I think there is a lesson here that we've stumbled upon, and the science of contact will allow us to get back to understanding what we, our abilities to start with,
yes.
And that we don't need to be led by anybody, and to be convinced of one God or another, that that force which is interacting with us, which is a higher mind in another place, is capable of tremendous things, but working with us, we're part of it. And I don't want to get too, obviously too political, but we only have to look at our television sets right now to know how dire it is that we pull back, the direction in which we are heading. I think most of the world has woken up to this, to be perfectly honest with you, that we're not understanding this problem at the UN and at NATO and so on, is because that I think the intelligence agencies should be very worried about what's happening now, because the collective consciousness of mankind does realize that what he's hearing is lies, that effectively we are being deceived for too long by too many, and we have to grab this back. I think this is what it's all about.
Well, interestingly enough, I'm divided about that. I think that it might be about, in effect, jumping up over the wall, reaching a point where we enter a new level of consciousness, and suddenly there's nothing to grab back because we all understand what we need to do and where we really are.
Right.
I hope that
I respect that.
Yeah, I hope certainly that something like something happens to stop this spiral downward, because things are changing so rapidly. I recently had on my website, in my journal, which I keep on the website, one called Strange Days, which was about all of the changes that we're seeing around us, including, I think, a very profound one, which is that the Earth's magnetic field is going into flux, and it is not structured in the normal way anymore, and there's every evidence building that for the first time in 750,000 years the polarity of the magnetic field is going to flip and change. I don't
yes.
mean the planet's going to turn upside down, by the way,
right,
but that its polarity is going to flip, and if that happens, it will be an extraordinary experience for mankind, because we have no idea what it will be like. No human being, no creature like us existed on this planet the last time it happened.
Right.
So we have no idea what it will do. But I bring it up specifically in this context because there is some kind of magnetic or electromagnetic phenomenon connected with the circles and with our brains.
Absolutely.
Now, tell us a little bit now what we know about the circles that are definitely being formed in some unknown way, about what may be happening to create them, physically, I mean.
Excuse me. Well, what we know are that, first of all, the plants, having endured the construction phase, and the placement of plants into a geometry, that those plants are changed in some fashion. We've looked at that now through two sets of eyes. One is the non-conventional, which is the spicknalysis, is a German process, which effectively looks at the moisture removed from the plants inside the crop circles.
Right.
And, you know, there's a starch crystal formed from that, by that moisture, and compared with the same process on the controls nearby, and that the lattice structure of those starch crystals are markedly different, but that they move back from being markedly different over a period of about 3 weeks to normal over that period of time. Well, through the conventional processes, through Levengood in particular, in this country, and I think you've had Nancy Talbot,
yes,
from his organization on a number of times. These plants,
I've only had her on once.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Well, these plants are changed at the cellular level that supports,
right,
the fact that something has changed. Well, the process, having taken place, has affected the plants. But what we have measured now, this is now, I think this will be the sixth year that we've been looking at the Earth's magnetic field, which is where we came from to get here,
right,
on this, is that in measuring the Earth's magnetic field, the mean level of magnetism is increased by about 150%, and has a profile, that is, if you look at the magnetic profile, is almost identical, you could, for all intents and purposes, say that it was, to the design that it's been measured over. Now, we have not excavated and have measured the magnetic field below ground level, but we do know for 20 feet above ground level that we have the contour, the 3D design of the 2D on the field as a magnetic profile. So my theory is at this time, in looking at all of the data, is that there is a localized anomaly which causes the magnetic field not to rotate, because it would be impossible, unless you pull dipoles away from the planet itself. Is that the Earth's magnetic field has a localized movement in a clockwise or anticlockwise circular direction, but are not completing the 360 revolution, causing a current to be induced in the plants. The analogy would be that those plants are electrocuted into a design. But there's something missing, and of course all the people that I'm in touch with and working with on this acknowledge the fact that the magnetic field, whilst it is a force, it doesn't have a lateral force capable,
mm-hmm,
of flattening plants like this.
No.
So there is a brother or sister to magnetism, which we don't have here yet. But nonetheless, these are measurements carried out with magnetometers that show that the Earth's magnetic field is giving us some information related to the crop markings.
This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. Colin Andrews stunned the world by saying 80% of crop circles were man-made, but what nobody heard was the other side of that statement. 20% of them were truly anomalous, and that's why he calls his new book, Crop Circles, Signs of Contact. That's right, Signs of Contact. Is there an esoteric code hidden in their patterns? Are they manifestations of human consciousness? Could they be screams from a dying planet? Are they some kind of warning signal or danger? Are they made by aliens? What a book, Crop Circles, Signs of Contact. Colin has said 80% of them are man-made, but even that is very, very strange. And that other 20%, we're looking straight into the eyes of another world. Get Crop Circles, Signs of Contact from the unknowncountry.com store. Just click on store. We'll take it from there. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're back. We're talking to Crop Circle investigator extraordinaire Colin Andrews. His new book, Crop Circle, Signs of Contact. Colin, I want to now get into the effects of crop circles on people who enter them. And I will begin by saying that first I was fascinated, and I will certainly bring up the business in your book about male physiology and what happens. But before I do that, I want to just say this. We had a very humble little crop circle here in South Texas. Physically, it was humble. It was about 3 weeks old before I heard about it. The farmer involved had taken the story of the crops, tried to get MUFON to investigate the crop circle, and they wouldn't touch it. But as soon as I heard about it, I got Southwest Research Institute and the local Mind Science Foundation, and we, a whole caravan of us, went down there armed with every piece of equipment we could possibly think might be of use. And
right.
We took physical samples and we made videotape. We did everything, including using a magnetometer, which I did. And while I was in the circle, we had marvelous, even the video was something else. It turned out as a magnetic phenomenon, the circle was a powerhouse. Because when you pointed the video camera at it, you could still see what you were looking at on the screen, but then when we later looked at the video, every time the camera was pointed directly at the circle, it was Brownian movement on the tape. The tape didn't register anything.
Interesting.
Yes. So I was in there, and I was using this device and moving about in the circle when I suddenly felt like I was going to collapse.
Yeah.
And I had to go sit in the car, and I didn't really recover until the next day. I was really completely incapacitated by this devastating weakness.
Yeah.
Now, from there, let's go into all of the different good and bad things that happen to people in crop circles.
Well, I certainly identify with your experience. I've been in many of them, probably a couple of thousand in the last 20 years, and normally the experience is a good one. It's a one of well-being, but I have indeed been in some that have made me feel extremely unwell. Within a couple of hours, feeling nauseous, lifeless. So I can certainly identify with it. But
lifeless, that was it. It's the most amazing. I never had another experience like it. I never felt like it before since.
No, I fully understand. And there is no question that it's real. You couldn't imagine to be that so unwell.
Yeah.
And it comes on very suddenly. It's
yeah.
like a dehydration. Really extremely nasty. And this is fairly widely reported. Really just a handful of occasions when I've had the same experience. The normal one for me, and most people, is of upliftment and a feeling of well-being. I've always felt very, very happy to be in them, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been a very nice experience. But there are all kinds. I mean, some people report their stoppings vibrating. I've spoken to several people who have had that experience.
Their what's vibrating?
The stoppings, that we call them fillings in the UK. This is what
fillings,
Yeah,
okay.
The fillings in your teeth, like a vibration, like a resonance you can feel within the tooth itself, whether that is the movement of the magnetic field, we don't know. We simply don't know. I believe that you were getting at, and I would say straight away, this is not an experience that I've had myself, but certainly a number of males that I know refer to an erection, having an erection inside these designs. So that is there too.
Yes.
I think it's just about the whole gambit of feelings. But one wonders whether, you know, there's a little bit of a placebo thing here, that it's what you imagine that you're in, it manifests a byproduct within you. So if it is a mysterious feeling for you and a mysterious experience, that it activates some part of your body, the physical, and manifests in real ways. It's very hard to know. I think that we've got to continue to come at this with a very wide vision, with as much science as we can throw at it. We know we have a magnetic element to this. The electrostatic field is certainly another one, which is hard to explain, that we have very extraordinary readings that do need to be explained away somewhere down the road. We know the plants are changed, you know, at the cellular anatomic level. So there's a lot that we know, but the bits that really matter, I don't think we do.
Yes, not yet.
Not yet, not yet.
And that perhaps is the true power of the crop circle there, in that it is forcing us to live with this question. And I, you know, I think even in the scientific community, I know quite a few people and who are aware, and it bothers them that this exists.
Yeah.
And whose feelings about it were actually intensified when they heard your 80-20 statement, as it seems like everybody in the Western world did.
Yeah.
Then they thought, my God, there really is a mystery here. Now, let me ask you this. The physical effects can be profound. Is it not true that people have those effects, whether the crop circle is man-made or unknown?
I'd be in a much better position to answer this with confidence next year, because we are just about to be throwing quite a lot at this. This is exactly where we are. There are indeed cases that look convincing, that certainly we know patterns to have been made by people. There's some of that 80% that I've been referring to, and have a catalogue from other sources of claims of well-being and illness and all kinds of strange physical feelings. So what we want to do at this point now is to draw this up with full scientific protocols, and to run through the comparisons with the man-made and those that we cannot explain. This has to be done clearly to know just exactly the value of the machines that we're looking at here, if that's what they are. It's quite possible that if you produce a geometry of many thousands of plants that affect, they have a life force which changes their electrical qualities, their capacitance, by laying them from the vertical into the horizontal, it produces a natural electrical field, which is interacting, of course, to some small, very minute degree with the Earth's magnetic field, and therefore, you know, whether it is man-made or not, it's got to have some kind of effect. Well, if you then have a geometry that with an axis aligned to the Earth's magnetic pole, it is quite conceivable that we are looking at tools that can be useful to us and that we can produce at call, on call. And so this is definitely an area that we need to go. There are many people have already started, I think, to look in this direction. And that this is where, actually, I'm putting together now, I think it's 5 or 6 projects that we are, I hope, about to get some very substantial funding for. And so therefore, that's one question, I think, Whitley, that we'll be in a better position to talk to with confidence fairly soon, hopefully.
Tell me where this, you think, the phenomenon is going. There have been some, I want, before we're finished, to just refer briefly to the figures at Chilbolton, and the one, I forget what it was called, what ultimately was decided to be called, with the disc with the alien face.
Yeah. I refer to numbers, so I'm not going to be particularly useful. But
okay.
Certainly, yes, I know the name. The ET with the disc.
Right.
Yeah.
What do you think of these formations?
Well, I'm going to be very disappointing here to some of your listeners I know, because I don't think there's any question that they were extremely well-executed man-made productions. I've spoken to the people who I am near convinced made them, and I'm near convinced on a number of grounds. One is that they were made over a period of time, over several days, in several stages, that the whereabouts of some of the individuals concerned were known, and known to have moved from London to that locality during that that period, that the method used for the construction of them was repeated one weekend of last year, when four faces appeared the same night using the same method, and I was alerted by those individuals that this was going to happen. So this was going to be ultimate proof that at least the four faces that are produced last year were made by these people, and were exquisite, really. They were exquisite. What they had proved to me was that indeed they are now working with a process that can produce tremendous patterns and with tremendous accuracy. But that aside, it still cannot account for this, the features in the 20%.
Now, I thought that those were pretty sinister, the Chilbolton and the other alien face, and these other four faces too. The reason is that they represent a kind of propaganda, an attempt to convince people that the question is closed.
Yeah.
And that kind of scared me. I wasn't too bothered by the Chilbolton ones, although I had reasons to feel somewhat uneasy about them. I was made very uneasy indeed by the one with the big alien face, because it was then very clear, there was no question in my mind about it, someone wanted to identify this particular form with aliens.
Yeah.
As phenomenon with aliens, and therefore to close the question. And I think that closing the question saps the energy of the whole experience and renders meaningless the circles themselves.
Yeah.
I think it's very, very destructive thing to do, and it's frightened me because I've come across some profound evil in my experiences.
Yeah.
It's out there.
Yeah.
And I worried that these people may have been infected with it without knowing it, and we've begun to do evil without realizing what they were doing.
They're dealing with. That's an astute observation on your part, and I would say my feelings are very similar with regard to those particular designs, for perhaps different reasons. Again, I haven't spoken of this before publicly, but I, as you know, was one of the advisors to the Mel Gibson Disney movie Signs.
Yes.
And during this process, I wasn't heavily involved at all, but I provided data and provided the some of the material for their promotional phase of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told during my time in working with them, actually I'll name the person, there's no point in not doing so, is Warren Betts, who was the head of publicity for that movie with Disney, told me that the executives at Disney approached him to ask him basically what he thought of the idea of mobilizing some teams of people around the world to make particular designs that would act effectively
to hype the movie.
To promote the movie, but only not by name, but simply by placing alien faces, which was to be the platform for the movie itself. And whilst I can't say on this program that I have 100% evidence that Disney was the money behind those faces of the disc, I have grave suspicions that they were. I certainly know that it was planned by Disney to do something of that kind, and I think that it's possible that that was part one of some of their activity. As you know, the movie itself, which I think was gravely disappointing, I have to say, and not only to the subject of the crop circles, but to our quest for the truth with regard to the ET problem, if it is that. But I think they did nothing but a disservice to us all with that movie.
Well, I regarded it just as a piece of entertainment.
Yeah.
I didn't go into it expecting anything else because it was based on War of the Worlds, which is
right.
also just a piece of entertainment. But I did find that those things to be touching on something that when you address this stuff, any of this phenomenon, you come immediately face to face with choices, inner choices that can be profound and powerful. And when you're talking about movie executives, I know many movie executives, and I won't say all of them are heels and soul blind, et cetera, and so forth, but there is certainly an element of that that's strong, and
yeah.
probably I wouldn't be too surprised if it was present in Disney, that they would never occur to them that there would be anything wrong with doing that. It would just simply be a fun way of getting people interested in crop circles when the movie was coming out.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And they'd be perfectly innocently doing that, and then reducing the energy of the phenomenon without realizing
exactly
it.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Certainly not productive as far as our quest for knowledge
no.
is concerned. I take your point that, I guess it's the only way we can see it, that Hollywood is entertainment.
Right.
But unfortunately, there's a lot of it there, and our kids, I think, are heavily influenced by it, so there's that other side to it. But I agree and accept that at the end of the day, it's entertainment. We can't be looking to Hollywood to educate us, that's for sure.
No, but we certainly can be looking to you and to the many other crop circle researchers who are out there struggling with this extraordinary phenomenon. Colin Andrews, one of the grand masters of crop circle research, his new book, Crop Circles, Signs of Contact.